I'm going to try to spend the next 45 minutes or so trying to explain alcoholism and drug addiction. I get a chance to speak a lot of different places, folks. I'm going to be in Oklahoma this weekend, and I'm going to be introducing myself as Chris Raymer. I'm a recovered alcoholic and addict, and that's what I am. I mean, my one claim to fame is not that I've got a bunch of degrees after my name. My one claim to fame is that 16 years ago, after years trying to get well, I finally did certain things that people asked me to do, and I recovered from this disease. And I'm pretty passionate about it. I know that some of the things I'm going to say tonight may be a little controversial to you. The fact that I introduce myself as a recovered alcoholic is pretty controversial to a lot of people. A lot of you family members have already done what my family did, I'm sure, when this terrible disease started creeping down the pike. You guys ran to the library or ran to B. Dalton's and got every book you could read on alcoholism and drug addiction. And the good news is you've got some education about it. The bad news is most of it was absolute crap. Okay, so I don't know what's wrong with my nose tonight. And that's as close to a cuss word as I'm going to get. I'm going to try to be good about the cussing, but it is. It's just garbage. It's just rubbish. It's just absolute rubbish. The stuff that's published about alcoholism and drug addiction out there, they fill libraries. I mean, there's thousands of titles on recovering alcoholics and addicts, and most of it is just, it's somebody's opinion on something they know nothing about, but they can make a dollar on it because it sounds good. And so everything I'm going to talk about tonight, folks, comes from a thing called the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was the original textbook. Anybody got one on handy on them? Ah, here's one. That's good. Yeah, thanks. Appreciate it. You got any boogies on it?
No. All right.
This is the big book right here. I sell these over in the little store if any of you guys would like to come pick up a copy of this. They're rather inexpensive. I can get you guys one for about $7. It's not any big deal. The first 164 pages is the textbook. It was published in 1939. And in this book explains what an alcoholic and a drug addict is, and how to recover from it. It's pretty simple stuff. And what the heck? If any of you family members would like to get on the same page, this would be a great investment to purchase. They don't sell these in B. Dalton bookstores. You know, you can't buy these in Border Books. And so, consequently, a lot of you guys kind of missed the main topic here. You with us? Don't know what to tell you. I will say this, if there was a better book out there, you with us? For $18,000, we'd be giving it to these patients. Having said that, all the stuff I'm going to talk about tonight comes out of that. This is not Chris Raymer's opinion, and I'm not trying to share opinion with you tonight. I'm just trying to share some hope with you, because I guarantee you, I had a lot of people over the years, we were talking about it this morning, a lot of people over the years, very, very well-meaning people, tell me bald-faced lies, and I don't want to do that tonight. I want to make sure that we're sticking pretty close to the truth. I want to try to help you see what alcoholism and drug addiction is. And the first thing I need to tell you, right off the bat, let me show you these statistics on the board here. Put my little specs back on. Look at that, broke them again. Brand new and I broke them again. Oh, man, brutal. These stats, I just got this email today from Dallas. These are the statistics out of the Dallas Intergroup, the 2003 statistics this past year. In 2003, we sold over 19,000 Desire Chips, little tokens that alcoholics pick up when they come into an AA meeting and they ask them if they want to stay sober, and they said, yeah, and they give them a little chip. Most of these patients have got a little Desire Chip already in their pocket. They picked one of these up, right? Y'all know what I'm talking about? Just a little aluminum chip. If you stay sober 30 days, you get a little red chip. If you stay sober 1 month, you get a little red chip that says 1 month, and then 2 months and 3 months, it goes on, and then you get the year. Look how much they dropped off in the first day they picked them up at 19,698. 1 month, 1,582. Look at that drop. This year in, year out, we've been following these statistics since 1993, since I started working out here. Look at this right here. 1 year chips, 1,385. I'll do the math for you because the guy did it for me. That's 7%. You with us? When that textbook was published in 1939, we had success rates that were through the ceiling. In 1955, we still had success rates of between 65 and 75% getting well. And today, right now, in one of the largest cities in Texas, heaven forbid, we've got a 7% success rate. Now, folks, something's wrong here. 1955, a lot of people were getting sober. And today, hardly anybody's getting sober. There's a reason. It's not rocket science. It's a reason. Reason is we stopped talking about the solution, which is spiritual in nature. We stopped talking about God. Everybody wants to be socially correct. Well, I got to tell you something, folks. If that's social correctness, we're not going to be very correct tonight. It's not talking about religion. We don't care. The fellowship was not based on anybody's belief in a certain religion. It is based on having a thing called a spiritual. First thing I want to tell you, going out of the chute here, folks, probably the most controversial thing I'll say all night. Alcoholism and drug addiction is not causal. Alcoholism and drug addiction is not caused by something out there. It's genetic. We understand it. We've known it for years and years and years. It's documented. There is no debate about it other than the people that don't believe it. I don't know what to say about that. A lot of well-meaning people killing people trying to look for the reasons that we drink too much. Y'all with us? It's genetic, and that's what we want to do tonight. In a few minutes I've got with you, I want to show you the symptoms of what alcoholism and drug addiction looks like. And in some of you family members, you can look at this, you can check for yourself and see if maybe possibly you have a problem with this too. I think this is a great idea. I'm sure some of you family members don't, but because if it's genetic, the chances are that somebody in our family is also suffering from the same problem. I've got an identical twin brother that's just like me. He was an alcoholic. My little sister has never had a problem with alcohol. She freaks me out. I've talked about her on more tapes than she can shake. She is the epitome of what we would call a normal drinker. She'll sit down and have a glass of wine and drink that whole glass of wine if it tastes good. If it tastes a little funky, you know, how wine can get sometimes, it just doesn't taste right. But so they tell me, she'll slide it across the table. I'd say, Lisa, what's wrong with your wine? She says, it just tastes a bit off. Off? Off? I don't care if there's a dead cricket floating in it. I mean, I don't. Off? I'm not drinking the stuff because it tastes good. I drink it because it gets me downtown. It fixes something wrong in me. And that's the difference. I want to show you here. Somebody needs to move this someday before I kill myself on it. All right. About 15% of us genetically, folks, are wired alcoholic and addict. This is what I want to show you. The main point of this lecture, I want you guys to see. We're going to divide the room up in a little group of alcoholics and addicts. And normal drinkers or hard drinkers. You with us? There's a difference between an alcohol abuser, drug abuser, and somebody that suffered from the disease of alcoholism and drug addiction. You with us? A lot of people out there in the world abuse alcohol and drugs. You with us? Look at MTV, Spring Break, 2003. You know what I'm saying? There's a lot of them drunk little knuckleheads out there on the beach running around naked abusing alcohol and drugs. But most of those cats end up back on Monday morning, back at school, studying their butt off, trying to play catch up. You with us? The 15% of that group, though, are still on the beach someplace. y'all with us? You understand? There's a difference. And I want to explain the difference tonight because, you know, everybody that drinks is not an alcoholic. Everybody that drinks a lot is not an alcoholic. You'll follow us? The quantities that we drink really doesn't come into matter here. And that's a key piece. A lot of you guys in here, moms and dads, because you were able to stop given sufficient reason, you assume that your 17-year-old son should be able to do the same thing. It's a logical assumption, but it's not true necessarily. It's genetics. It's just like being allergic to food, for heaven's sakes. I mean, some of you cats in this room are allergic to food and you can't eat it. Just because you're allergic to a food doesn't mean that you were potty trained weird or something. You know, I mean, we're not going to have to go back in and try to find out the deep rooted family secret that caused you to be allergic to shrimp, for heaven's sakes. You're allergic because genetically that's the way you were wired. Make sense? It's the same with alcoholism and drug addiction. And we want to make it so dadgum complicated. It's not. There's a percentage with us. It's got nothing to do with the way you were raised or the amount of money you got. It's just that's just the way you were born. Some of you guys are blind. Some of you, we haven't got a clue what color. It's different every day. We may never know. All right. Let me show you what an alcoholic and addict looks like. And family members, I don't want you to get freaked out here. If this starts sitting a little close to home and you start seeing that maybe you've got some of these symptoms, don't worry about it. We got plenty of orange bands for you. All right. All right. Three parts. Alcoholism and drug addiction's got three parts. This is like qualifying. When I first got to Alcoholics Anonymous, they said, "Chris, you got a problem with alcohol?" And I said, "Uh-huh." I was drunk at the time. And I said, "Uh-huh." And they said, "Well, welcome. And sit down." And I sat down in a chair, and I, like deer in a headlight, says, "Well, that all there was to it?" That was. That's why I couldn't stay sober, folks, because I call myself an alcoholic, but calling yourself an alcoholic or a drug addict doesn't make you one. Make sense? The book says that I got to be convinced to my innermost self that I'm the real McCoy. It's the toughest job that we have out here with these patients, is trying to get them to understand what one looks like and then identify with it. Because if you can't identify, you're not one of us. It's like you can't be a little bit alcoholic, folks. You either are one of us or you're not. Make sense?
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
Is it a genetic problem that you have?
Uh-huh.
But to identify this?
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. I'm fixing to give it to you right now.
Okay.
That's it. Come on. Stick with me. No, there's not. A scientific test with genetics, they will be able to do it. They're right on the cusp of it right now. They've been studying this stuff since the mid-80s, hard and heavy. They understand it's a genetic predisposition, without question. When we get to find that, we'll be able to find out what causes cerebral palsy and thousands of other diseases that we would love to know at an early age. Let me show you real quick. Alcoholism and drug addiction is three parts, folks. I'm going to show you. We're going to talk about each one of these pieces. It's pretty simple. And then you can identify. Look at your truth based on your experience and see if you can identify with what we're saying. And some of you are going to be able to identify and some of you won't. That's a pretty cool thing. Here's the first piece, the physical piece. When I put alcohol or drugs in my body, are there times that a phenomenon of craving will kick in and I will end up drinking more than I intended? Normal people drink exactly what they intended and then they stop. Alcoholics and addicts can do that many times. But there are times when this phenomenon of craving kicks in and they end up drinking or drugging more than they intended. Normal people never do that. Make sense? A normal person, give me a normal person. A normal person that's a family member. Are you normal? Are you an alcoholic?
No.
Jesus, you look like an alcoholic. No. What does an alcoholic look like, hon? And we all look like alcoholics. How can you tell it? Look at somebody and see if they're an alcoholic or an addict or not. That's the point I've got to make. What does an alcoholic and addict look like? We all look like alcoholic and addict. This is internal stuff. It's got nothing to do with external. That's stereotypical stuff right there. Believe it. What I got to have a trench coat on and be running around peeping in windows to be qualified as an alcoholic? Absolutely not. What happens when you drink? We're going to go and have a couple of beers. What happens after the second beer? What if you don't want to?
I can drink.
What happens if we have 16 beers? This is good. You got that orange band? All right. Here's what's going to happen in a normal drinker. A normal drinker is going to start drinking, and they're going to get to a certain place where it starts to feel uncomfortable. They'll start feeling dizzy a little bit. That's what, like my little sister. No, thank you. I'm starting to feel it. It's like, no kidding. Me too. How about another one? You know. But you got to understand. Alcohol in you, Kay, is going to be different than alcohol in me. We assume that alcohol in each of us makes us feel the same way. And you need to understand that somebody with a genetic predisposition, alcohol reacts different in my body than it may react in yours. About the time you're starting to lose control and feeling uncomfortable, I'm gaining control and feeling very comfortable. It's just... An alcoholic or a drug addict, once we start to drink or drug, there are times, not every time, but there are times we'll end up putting more in our body than we really should. And we intuitively know we probably shouldn't be putting that much in, but we do it anyway. That's because of a phenomenon called craving that separates us from other people. Make sense? I can give you a graphic illustration. How many alcoholics and addicts in here ever got sick drinking? Raise your hand. Let the record show they all raised their hands. How many of you went back in and continued to drink? Let the record hold, they all continue to raise their hands. You with me? I mean, why would you do that? Why would you get sick and go back in and drink again? Wiping your mouth, you know, must have been the chicken, you know? We're justifying out the kazoo about what that's about, okay? Physical peace is pretty easy to understand. Most of us don't have a problem with the physical peace. Understanding that, and it's easy to treat the physical peace. We call it detox. A lot of times we'll get patients in here that are addicted to medication, and what they need is to be detoxed off that medication or off the alcohol. And we can do that through a period of step down and wean them off of that substance. And at the end of that, they're drug-free. The phenomena of craving won't take place anymore, and they'll be okay. You with us? See, this is where a lot of people get confused, like my friend Nancy Reagan, who seems to think that all we need to do is just say no. And this is what you guys got to say, because I'm not trying to be disrespectful here to Miss Reagan, bless her heart, but she does not understand. You see, it's the combination of the two pieces that make alcoholics and addicts and make this such a fatal illness. You see, the next piece, the mental piece, is this thing called choice. An alcoholic and addict has lost the power to choose whether they're going to do this or not. Our willpower becomes practically non-existent at certain times around the alcohol and drugs. Even when I've been given 1,000 reasons not to put it back in my body, I do it anyway. That's the insanity that the book talks about when it's referring to this disease. One of the toughest pieces for the patients to swallow, and it's the one of the absolute toughest piece for the family members to swallow. Can you manage the decision to stay stopped? One of the things I got to make real clear here, guys, there were a lot of times when I first started drinking, when I was a kid, that alcohol was and drugs was fun, and even though it was causing me some problems, I didn't really want to stop. But there was a period of time in my 19, 20-year drugging career, that I really, really, really wanted to stop. And I really, 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 really needed to stop. You with me? Legal problems, wife that wanted me to quit, compromised health. I really had to stop. And I made 100 valiant attempts at stopping. But I couldn't stay stopped. I could stop for short periods of time if enough pressure was on me. But I couldn't make it stick. You with us? A hard drinker or a hard drugger will be able to, under any major circumstance like that, to stop on their own power. A college student going to school, it starts jeopardizing their grades. They realize that their GPA's dropped. My gosh, it's all around the party, and I quit. And they never touch another drink. You with us? A guy will be out partying, have a DWI, get caught up in the legal system. I'm done. I'll never touch another drop. They stop. They drank. They looked a lot like alcoholic and addict. They did a lot of the same crazy stuff that we did. But they had the power to stop on their own power. They didn't need a spiritual experience. They just got slapped and said, I'm done, and were able to quit. Folks, I got to tell you, in 1982, when I was married, first wife, and we had a little shoving match one night, and the cops came, and geez, I went back in after it was all said and done and apologized to her. And, you know, I remember her words. She said, Chris, you know it was the alcohol and the cocaine that did it. And I said, without question, I know it was the alcohol and cocaine. She said, then would you stop? Do you want this marriage to succeed? And I said, absolutely. I did. She was a wonderful woman, still is today in Houston, Texas. Wonderful woman. She said, Chris, then you're going to promise me you'll quit. Yes. Had some cocaine left, dumped it out. Dumped all the booze out. Stayed sober for 2 weeks. End of the second week, somebody offered me a beer, turned the first one down. Nope, on the wagon. Second, third one passed by, and my mind said, you... Mental obsession kicked in. I put one in my body, the phenomenon of craving kicked in, and I drank one more. and went home, patting myself on the back. Hi, honey, I'm home. Walked up the steps. She opened the door. You know how they can do. She knew I'd been drinking. Didn't even have to talk to me. Shut the door in my face. Went and packed. See, my deal with Karen wasn't that I was not going to get drunk anymore. My deal with Karen was that I wasn't going to drink anymore. Period. I have some choices in my life, folks. I have the choice whether or not I'm going to get on this spiritual path, whether I'm going to enter recovery and stay there. Those are choices that I can make. But if I choose not to do that, if I choose to say, to heck with God, I don't need that, I'm going to be okay by myself, then all bets are off. The mental insanity will return and I will die. What's 100% fatal. That's why it's so imperative that we all get clear on the same page with this business. When we have somebody that relapses, folks, it's not that they decided to go drink again. It's that they got sick again and the drink took them over. You with me? Let me tell you the third piece. It'll clear some of this up for you. This third piece, perhaps a graphic illustration can help you guys understand that. Here's a little guy we call Issue Man. We draw him up here on the board about 1,000 times a week. This Issue Man, he could be Issue Woman too. Boop, there you go. It's like the patients. It's a little Issue Man, okay? This internal condition that the big book talks about, most treatment centers won't talk about. This is the only treatment center I've ever been around where we really spend a lot of time talking about the spiritual malady that the book talks about, a spiritual illness. It's got nothing to do with a belief in God. There's a lot of us in these rooms that believe in God quite heavily, but belief in God and access to that God is two separate things. The spiritual malady is very real. I'm going to give you the symptoms of what the spiritual malady looks like. Some of you family members that are sitting in here with significant others, or especially if you're in here with your kids, see if you can see these symptoms in them. I think you can. How about irritable? Symptom of the spiritual malady, irritableness. How about restlessness? Discontent. Fearfulness. Depression. Number one symptom of alcoholism and drug addiction is depression, folks. We've been treating it with a stupid pill forever. When I finally got sober in 1987, I was taking 7 pills a day just to maintain. And it had been more if I'd gone to more doctors. You with me? Not knocking the medical fraternity. They're trying to help the best way they can. But a pill for an alcoholic is not the answer. How about boredom? Anxiety? Trouble making a living? Trouble in personal relationships, low self-esteem, feeling of uselessness is how the book explains it. Here's one for you. What is this constant need for others' approval? We call it codependency out here. What it is an internal condition that demands your total attention 24/7. And when we don't get it, we're coming apart at the seams. That's internal. All of this is internal. Every bit of that's internal. This is what gets treated by the recovery program of action that's outlined in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. This internal condition, once treated, is alleviated. See, a lot of the cats in this room believe, a lot of you family members, I'm sure, are convinced that the alcohol is the problem, that the cocaine is the problem, that the pills are a problem. It's not. The alcohol and drugs are the solution. When you take alcohol and drugs away from me as an alcoholic, I get worse, not better. Some of you family members that have lived around us in our dry times know exactly what I'm talking about. I become so irritable, restless, and discontent, I can't stand it. My first wife, that Karen, when we were talking about, she'd come home after a particular long dry spell and set a bottle of vodka down and says, "Here, drink this." Says, "Honey, I'm sober." She says, "Buddy, there's nothing sober about you. Drink it so we can still live together because you're driving me nuts." You with us? Understand it. The problem is not the booze and the drugs. That's why this just say no stuff is rubbish. The problem is the internal condition. This is why treatment centers do such a terrible job treating alcoholics and addicts. We've got treatment centers all over this country going out of in a time when we need them the worst, because they're not explaining this internal condition. All they're doing is focusing on what? Issues. The external symptoms. And the external stuff, let me tell you what happened to me. Here. That's good. That's pretty good, isn't it, Kay? We use me as an example so nobody gets freaked out, but I think every patient in here can identify with what I'm talking about. I spent, from the early 70s, worried about my drinking and drugging. I was in the food business, and I'd gone to Houston specifically. I grew up here in the Hill Country, but I'd gone away in about 1973, I guess, to Houston and gotten an apprenticeship program, and I was going to make a whole bunch of money and find me a classy city woman and quit drinking. I mean, that was the deal. Make a lot of money, and I did a lot of that. Found some, in fact, more than one city woman, and it was tall cotton, and made a bunch of money, and was real did well in my career. But the bottom line about this drinking piece is I wouldn't have any luck staying sober. So I started my little trek into therapy at that point. And again, I'm not knocking therapy. I had many years of great therapy. I got to learn a lot about myself. But the therapists were interested in not only talking about the internal stuff, because they couldn't see that. They're looking at the external stuff, trying to find out what it is out there that I'm so upset about that I have to keep drinking. Make sense? I mean, we do this all the time. We talk endlessly about mama. How many of you guys ever been in therapy and talk about mama? Yeah? Non-stop we talk about mama. I know about me and mama more than I know about me and anything else. It just drives me crazy. You know, we established quite early on that moms are evil. Okay, so we got that out of the way. And then we talked about dads, because you know, I mean, they're almost as evil as moms. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. We talked about my identical twin brother. We talked about my little sister, my half-sister. We talked about growing up in the Hill Country. We talked about that sheep. And we talked a lot about... talked about being in the food business, working in the food business. You know, a lot of stress at that job. We talked a lot about that. We talked a lot about Vietnam. We laugh about it all the time. I've never been to Vietnam, but we talked a lot about it. You know, it was just it's kind of a hot topic with us back in the 70s. Every week we talk about it because I think it's important to talk about. We spend a lot of time in therapy talking about my sexuality. You know, sex is the root of lots of problems, and if you're kind of confused sexually, you know, it can cause a lot of, I don't know. I wanted to be gay so bad. I mean, I don't know. I'm just convinced that if I could just peg that, then I could have a good excuse. You know, that's why you drink so much, Chris. That's why you're doing so much cocaine, is because you got a unbelievable. And I'm not, you know, and I don't know what to tell you. Pretty soon, you know, it gets a little frustrating in therapy when you start running out of stuff to talk about. I've split every hair. I've turned over every rock. I had a great family. Still do. Good Christian folks that loved me more than anything. We got an industry out there that's got to blame this on somebody. Might as well be our family. I'm going to tell you something right now, folks. Alcoholism and drug addiction may be exasperated by these problems. It may be exacerbated by these problems. But these problems do not cause alcoholism and drug addiction. If this is the problem that's causing my alcoholism and drug addiction, I am not an alcoholic or an addict. I'm a hard drinker or a hard drugger, and all I need to do is do some good therapy and go on down the road. Well, I did that for years. 19, how can I explain this? 1982. I guess I'm up in North Texas. I spent years again jogging in my. How many of you guys understand what a geographical cure is? Y'all know. Y'all, have you ever heard that expression? Geographical cure is when we think that the problem is here in the Hill Country, so I'm going to move to Houston, Texas. Y'all with us? I mean, every day we get calls from people. You know, I can't stay sober. I'm moving. I said, buddy, where are you at now? Oh, I'm in Houston. I says, oh, that's great. Where are you going to move to? I'm going to move to Austin. He's like, oh, that's good. There's no. It's so stupid. And that's what I did. I went to Houston, then I went to Austin and for 2 years, then I went to Atlanta, Georgia, then I went to Vernon, Texas. It was a dry county then. Back then, you couldn't buy booze in Vernon, Texas. Well, you could if you drove 60 miles one way, and we did twice a week. You know what I'm saying? It's just like, I moved to Dallas. I moved back to Houston. I moved back to Houston. I think the last best count I've got is 6 times I moved back to Houston. Loved Houston, Texas. Moved back here to Kerrville for a period of time. Always, you know, unpack my stuff, get my little apartment, sit down. Oh, this is great. A new leaf. I'm going to turn over a new leaf. Everything's going to be good, right? Be sitting there for a few minutes looking around. Nobody in the room but me and me. You know, it's like, geez, this is fun. I think I'll go get a drink and celebrate, you know? Go get one beer. Phenomenal craving kicked in. And I had 6 more. And I'm off to the races again. You with us? God, if I could just get out of this food business, if I could just be a salesman, everything would be good. There you go. Steady drinking. Steady drinking. Sitting out by the lake reading the one ads with a 12-pack of beer on the floor. Steady drinking. Hate sales. Terrible at it. God, if I could just get back in the food business. Maybe those barbecue restaurants, after all, that'd be a good thing. There it is. Barbecue restaurant. Mine. God, if I could just get the catering company. Man, if I could just go back to school. God, if I could just buy the house. Damn. I'm doing exactly what every patient in this room is doing. God, if I could just change my external world, I could be okay in here. And that is so far from the truth, it's not even funny. But again, we've got an industry that supports that. We laugh about it all the time. I never forget sitting there. Sitting out in front of used to be an old bar in Houston called the Roundup. It's over there by Sunny Looks. And I sat in that parking lot, drunk on my butt, and said, God, if you'll let that waitress in there marry me, I assure you, good to my word, I'll stop drinking. 2 weeks later, we're married. Can you believe that? God answered every prayer I ever asked him. 2 weeks, we're sitting in that little garage apartment of mine over there by the Warwick Hotel, and she's shoveling Cheerios in her mouth, and I'm saying, God, if you could just kill this woman, everything's going to be okay. And this is what the patients do. God, if we could just get married. God, if we could just have kids. God, if we could just shoot the kids. You know, we could just get this, and we could just get that. We spend a lifetime trying to work our little circumstance. Y'all know the expression, get your ducks in a row? When I do lectures up in New York, I say that and everybody's just blank faces. Everybody looks sideways. Get your what in a row? It's like, you know what I mean about getting your ducks in a row. You know, you got the house and the car and the wife and the kids. I got everything lined up, you know? Because everything gets lined up, you don't have anything to drink over. Ridiculous. Because I'm not drinking over that external stuff. I've had my ducks in a row. Always lost it. That's why we got to stop getting on this treadmill trying to figure out what we need to do out here. Family, if you hear nothing else I say tonight, you got to hear this. You didn't cause this to happen, alcoholism and drug addiction, and you can't fix it. Period. Can you work through some issues and try to get a better relationship with some of us knuckleheads? Absolutely. It takes work. Let's work together. Let's do that. But don't think for a second it's going to make any difference whether we get sober or not. Let me tell you what happened. In 1987, I'm working for my brother up in Louisville. My twin brother's got a bookbindery up there, and I'm working in the warehouse. I'm an accredited chef and was good, but I couldn't be in the industry any longer because of the disease. I can't hold a knife. My hands are shaking too bad. And I'm just a mess. I mean, I can't guarantee you. But he looks the other way and helps me and stays close by. And that's one more reason why I feel so akin with the family members. God, if it hadn't been for family, I mean, I'd have been dead. I'd have been on my butt. I drove home one night and picked up a stack of return checks out of my mailbox. And it was November 1987, and it was cold like this outside. It was overcast. I'll never forget it. And I went up to my little apartment, and there was no place to sit. I had no furniture. The dope dealer had my furniture. I'd lend it to him. He said he liked it, and so I just thought, what the heck? You can have it. I traded it for dope, what I did. And I'm sitting in this apartment, and there's two ferrets in a cage over here and me and a stack of return checks. I got a great life, folks. I had to tell you, you know. My mom and dad have been proud of me, and I'm just so done, you know. I'm tired of taking the pills. They're not working. I'm tired of living the life I'm leading. I've exhausted my checking account one more time. There is no savings account. There is no credit cards. There is no woman. There is no nothing. 35 years old, and I am so tired of living, I could spit. Walked to the medicine cabinet, got a bottle of pills and some Black Label, and tried to commit suicide. Second time in adulthood. Same story, folks. I didn't want to die. I don't think anybody that commits suicide wants to die. I think they just want to stop feeling the way they're feeling. And I've got myself in a cul-de-sac. I can't get out. I've tried every avenue. I've tried therapy. I've tried the medication. I've tried treatment. I've tried staying away from slippery places and slippery things. And I've tried to do all the little stuff that they've told me to do, and it's just not working. I've been in churches. I've been in churches of very, you know, traditional kind. And I've been in churches that were built like teepees, for heaven's sakes. And I've sat naked in sweat lodges. And I've taken crystals and stuck them places we don't even want to talk about. And I've done a lot of things to try to get well, just like a lot of these cats here. Nothing would work. I tried to commit suicide. Laid down to die, and I heard this voice. Get this. I heard this voice that said, Chris, don't do it. Go back to AA. I've told this 1,000 times. It's still difficult to say without getting emotional. I don't know what I heard that night. I heard a voice that said, Chris, don't do it. Go back to AA. Don't have a clue. Now, I'd been in AA for 7 years, in and out, picking up chips. Nothing's working. Of course, the meetings I'm going to are not telling me what to do to get well. They're telling us to talk about our day, talk about our issues. Dig? They were killing me. Big Book says that selfish and self-centeredness is the root of my problems. So what are we going to do in a meeting? Talk about me. Why not? Forget the guy in the back that's dying of alcoholism and drug addiction. Let's don't worry about him. Let's just talk about me and my day. Unbelievable. I aborted that suicide attempt, obviously, guys. The next morning I got up and went to a doctor and got some doggy downers to detox. Couldn't go to treatment. I was busted flat. There was no money in that checking account. I made a commitment that afternoon that I was going to go to this meeting over there in Lewisville, Texas. I'd never been to this meeting, but I knew where it was. A guy had taken me over there one night. I knew where it was, and I went over there because I didn't want to be in the same room with people I'd been in before because I was embarrassed about coming back in. And I walked back into the room. Of course, it's the same people. They all knew me up in North Texas. I'm kind of hard to miss with this patch. You know what I mean? Oh, there's that pirate guy. Okay. So I walk in the back door of this meeting, and they're all carrying big books. This is a little big book. This is a little confusing. They're all carrying big books like that. All of them are carrying these books. And I think this is a literature meeting. This is a big book thumper nest I just walked into. I can't believe I did this. And I start to walk out, you know, because I don't want to be in a big book thumper room. I want to get in a place where I can talk about mama some more. You know what I'm saying? I can sit there and whine a little bit and tell all the women in there what a tragic life I have and perhaps get lucky tonight. You know, find somebody just as sick as I am that'll take me home. You know, I mean, it's worth a try, for heaven's sakes. That's what I was gunning for. But you know, these cats, they wouldn't have any of that. None of that. They got between me and the door, pulled me down in a chair and said, sit down. Got me a roll of paper towels to clean up my coffee because I was a little quick, you know, I kept shooting coffee. And they went around the room and they all started sharing. The chairperson said this, real quick, I won't take a lot of time talking about this, but the chairperson says, we got Chris back in here again. He's going to pick up another desire chip. He wants to try this again. He's been in AA for a long, long time, folks. He didn't need to hear all the stupid war stories. Let's share something different tonight. Let's share the miracles that have happened in our life as a result of getting on this spiritual path. As a result of getting sober and walking a spiritual path with God, let's talk about some of the cool things that are happening to us. You with us? And I remember sitting back thinking, oh, this is going to be good. I can't wait for this to start. You know, I'm making fun of them. I think this is a joke. Because you guys don't understand. Nobody understands. Nobody understands. All I need is some money to get those last hot checks taken care of and everything's going to be okay. And maybe get a woman that'll have sex more than once every 6 months. Now, if that's too much to ask, I don't know what is. Maybe a job where I could make a little whip, huh? Basically, what I need is somebody to talk to about maybe getting a new job. And then I could stay so unbelievable. Less than 24 hours away from a suicide attempt, and I still don't understand that the problem is internal, not external. And these guys went around the room, and guys, I got to tell you something. They talked about stuff that I could really understand. You know, they didn't talk about this, the spiritual nature of this. They didn't talk about any of this happy sunbeam for Jesus stuff. They talked about very, very specific things like getting your credit cards back, finding somebody that would absolutely love you in this world, getting to a place where your creative juices would start flowing again so you could do something that really meant something in this world. Buying a house, getting your kids back, being able to look in the mirror without wincing. Buddy, I got to tell you, those people loved me enough that night. They loved me enough. They're just like the people in this hospital. They loved us enough to tell us the truth. And they didn't candy coat it a bit. There wasn't anybody in that room that was trying to give me some sympathy. They were trying to give me some hope. And that's what I needed, was some hope. I'm not a little retarded kid, folks. I don't need to be treated like one. But everybody stayed away from me, treated me like I was a retarded kid because I expected it of them. And that night, they didn't do that. That night after the meeting, the old-timers got around me. There was two or three of these guys. One guy had about a year, and the rest of them had a little bit more. They got around me and they said, Chris, do you want to stay sober the rest of your life? Are you willing to make a commitment that from now on, you're done with the drinking and drugging? And I said, well, that's absurd. No. I mean, I'll do it one day at a time. You with me? They got their coffee and left the room. See, I've been around AA long enough to be dangerous. I could get at the little one-liners and the little catchphrases, you know. It says, Chris, we're not interested in working with somebody that just wants to stay sober today. We're interested in working with somebody that's made a commitment that they're done with that way of life. We didn't say you had the power to do it. We asked you if you wanted to stay sober for good and for all. Yeah. Yeah. Put it that way? Absolutely. The next morning I came back and we did a meeting and then went over in the room behind where the big meeting hall was and we got on our knees and we did a third step prayer. Second day of detox, I'm doing a third step prayer. That afternoon they gave me the information on how to do a fourth step. You'll see on this wall up here, we've written all over this. You see this thing? Made a searching and fearless moral inventory of, who's that? Me? No, I want to inventory mama some more. No, we've done that. We're finished with family members now. We're going to look at my stuff. Where have I been selfish and self-centered to the core? Where have I been dishonest? Where have I been full of fear? And I get to look at that stuff and I get to dump it with somebody in a fifth step. And then I get to go out and make amends to the people that I've screwed over. 3 days. Buddy, 2 weeks later, I've got a completed fourth step. I've got a guy lined up to do a fifth step. I'm already making amends. I'm praying and meditating, and they're already making me work with others. I'm doing more work in the first 2 weeks in this fellowship than I did in 7 years out there in AA land. Yeah, amen is right. Because a bunch of people cared enough to understand and to see that I didn't have time to get comfortable before I started doing this work. My very life depends on getting off my butt and finishing this work. Buddies, that was 16 years ago. Second week after I got there, I was talking to one of the cats earlier. The second week after I got there, I've got that completed four step and I drive home up in North Texas. 2 weeks later, in the same parking lot that I took those pills, and I pulled the tailgate down in my old truck. It was after an 8 o'clock meeting. And I'm sitting there and I'm looking at that big old full moon coming up. It's cold like a son of a gun up in North Texas. There's not a breath in the air. It's just as quiet as can be. You know, like it gets in Dallas, it's just crisp. It's so cold. And you can see the breath coming out. And it's like, and I'm looking around and I'm seeing that there's something different. There's a 7-Eleven and a Stop and Go. I'm surrounded by four different convenience stores where I can buy beer. There's a liquor store that I got a tab at right across the street. You with me? My cocaine dealer lives in the apartment complex where I live. It's Friday. I got a pocket full of money. And nobody but those stupid ferrets tell me no. You with us? Sometime by the time I walked into that room on November 13th, 1987, and that 2 week later period, I recovered from alcoholism and drug addiction. And I do not know when that was. But the obsession to drink and to do cocaine left. Never has returned in 16 years. I was as recovered as I was going to get. That's the beauty of this program, folks. This idea that recovery is a journey is a joke. Recovery is an event. When it takes place, the weight of the world will lift off your shoulders. You'll be as excited as you've ever been about living. And it'll either happen to you or it won't. Folks, I've been here 10 years. 10 years I've sat up here in this hospital and worked with these patients and got to watch thousands of these cats come through this hospital. And there's a select few of them that will look at this, understand it, identify with it, turn around and walk off this campus and do everything we ask them to do. Go to meetings, get a sponsor, finish these steps, and they'll have a spiritual experience that'll blow you out of the water. And there's a percentage of them that'll walk off this campus, and because they're the most selfish, self-centered people on earth. Oh, God. Y'all need to get the X-rated version. It's a lot more entertaining. They're the most selfish, self-centered folks on earth because they are. They're going to go do it their way. They're going to come up with every reason in the world why they don't have to do the things that we have to do to stay sober. And they will not stay sober. And they will drink again. It won't be that they'll choose to drink. They will choose not to seek the power of God. They will choose to do it on their own. At that point, the obsession to use returns, and they will be insane, and they will pick up a drink. Can't be that simple. It is. Some of you family members in here real quick are waiting for the bottom to come up and hit them in the butt. You're waiting for things to get bad enough for us to stop. And I want you to hear this tonight. It will never get bad enough for us to stop. Fear will not keep an alcoholic or an addict sober. So you cats in here that are trying to use threats and this kind of stuff to do it, you can forget it because it won't matter. You can threaten us with our life and it will not matter. How many patients play with us in here real quick before I got to go? How many of you patients in here drank and drug when you had lots of money? Raise your hand. All the hands. How many of you drank and drug when you had no money? All the hands. Same hands. How many when you was in a great big nice city? In a crappy little town like Ingram? All the same hands. You get the gist. How many when you was in a great relationship with somebody that you loved? How many when you was dating Satan's sister? Same hands. So you family members, relax. Because what you're coming to is the absolute crux of what I'm talking about tonight. If I'm going to get sober, the responsibility of my sobriety relies directly on my shoulders. My shoulders, not anybody else's shoulders. I've seen this too many times, folks. Everybody wants to try to find out who's going to stay sober and who's not. Forget it. Forget it. We won't know till they walk off this campus. The ones that put one foot in front of the other and seek the power of God like we're talking about by working these steps, finishing this work, they'll stay sober. And I don't, listen, folks, and I don't give a rat's butt about this. I don't care about this stuff out here. I'm not trying to be callous. I'm trying to say this is not going to matter. I've watched too many alcoholics and addicts come through this hospital that had everything in the world to live for and got drunk immediately. And I've watched cats that had an absolutely most tragic life you could ever imagine. Molestation, rapes, abuse, nonstop. That grasped the one little reed of hope that we gave them. Finish this work. And they did it, and they had their guaranteed spiritual experience, and the obsession left. And oh, by the way, there was enough power left over to deal with all of this other stuff that was driving them crazy. This is not about just living one day at a time sober, folks. This is not about not drinking and drugging at all. This is about getting some power in your life to go do the cool things you've always wanted to go do. It's the best job I've ever had was sitting on this campus, watching these patients walk off campus and change the world out there. Because so many of them do. The hoo-hoo of the people that have been in this hospital would impress anyone in here. The tragedy is that so many don't do it because they still will not buy the fact that my external world has got nothing to do with my internal world. And I hope you guys get it. I got these business cards up here, folks. I want all you family members to make sure you get one of these. It's got my 800 number. I'll be more than glad to give you my home number if you want to do that. You want to call me at home anytime. If it's after 10, it better be life and death. Because I'm an old man and I need my sleep. But 800 number's got my extension on it. If any of you guys got any questions or you got problems at home, it looks like the significant other is fixing to go do something stupid again, pick up the phone. You can whisper if you want to. It's okay. Pick up the phone and call me, and I'll get in the middle of it. We'll find out what's going on, okay? I love you guys. Thanks for being here.